Welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 1st of March, 2021, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Wow, the year is just absolutely racing past. It's the beginning of another week. It's glorious sunshine outside while we are recording this, and who better to begin the week with than Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. It's a glorious day here. How are you?
Very well indeed. It is a glorious day. Yes, I've been out cycling today. I cycled over 11 miles and according to my calculations, burnt up 800 calories doing that. So that was an hour or so well spent.
And, wow, that is just stop there. That's incredible. That 11 miles cycling. I mean, that is really hard work. You must be very, very fit, in order to do that, Max. Yeah, all credit to you for that. It's very rare that you hear somebody actually doing something like that. They talk about it, but they don't often do it.
Now, the only problem with cycling long distances is that the bicycle I've got at the moment has got a hard rear end to it, and so it does hammer your backside a fair bit, so you end up feeling like somebody's booted you up the bum after you've finished. But I'm getting a new bike, and it's going to have suspension at the rear, which is going to be good.
excellent stuff. I hear you were you've come across something in the news today about Gary Lineker and ethnic minorities in adverts. What's all this about?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, regular listeners will probably remember September last year that there was a video that Gary Lineker featured in, where this video was produced by an organisation called International Rescue Committee, I believe. And the main thrust of this video was that fish and chips was promoted as being our national dish, and then the video went on to demonstrate, or to claim rather than demonstrate, they claimed that fish and chips wasn't actually a British invention after all, and that we are beholden to immigrants for having introduced both the concept of fried fish and chips to us, and the combination of fried fish and chips. And that there was an individual who was mentioned by Jo Brand, who also took part in the video, where she said that this chap called Joseph Malin had invented fish and chips and the putting of fish and chips together. And I did an article on the Western Spring website, which was in September last year, where I completely debunked that story and showed that fried fish has been a staple of the British diet going back to like time immemorial. We weren't dependent upon Jewish immigrants to teach us how to fry fish. We knew how to fry fish before then, and it was, as I say, part of our diet. Also, the other thing I showed was that Joseph Malin wasn't even within the first 200 people to open a fish and chip shop in London. There were many, many more people who had invented fish and chips before he did. But anyway, coming on to the present day, Gary Lineker has again become embroiled in a bit of a race row as a result of taking part in a TV advertisement on this occasion. This is a TV advert for Kentucky Fried Chicken flavoured Walker's Crisps, because Gary Lineker has got a contract with Walker's Crisps to promote their crisps in TV adverts, which is great, and he's quite free to do that. But Walker's have teamed up with Kentucky Fried Chicken, and he's now come under attack because people are claiming that the advert is racist. And they're claiming that the advert is racist because, apart from Gary Lineker, the vast majority of other people in the advert seem to be people of black or ethnic minority origin. The advert begins with Gary Lineker eating a packet of crisps, and then the camera zooms along the streets where it focuses in on certain people and swoops by other people. Some of the people that it swoops by appear to me to be white, or you know, they could be white. So it isn't a sort of a stark black and white issue, no pun intended. The camera does tend to pan for slightly longer on a couple of women who are stood by the side of a bus stop, and one of them quite clearly is mixed race. The other one looks as if she's a very watered down mixed race origin. And they're eating out of a bucket of Kentucky Fried Chicken. And then the camera swoops into a barber shop where all three of the men in the barber shop are black men. It's claimed that this advert associates black and ethnic minority people with eating fried chicken, and that this is a trope that's been used in racial denigration of black people in the past in America, and that Walker's Crisps are in fact perpetuating this trope by producing this particular advert.
Well, it can't be though. They've got a token white man. They've got a token white man, haven't they? They've got Gary Lineker. How can it be a trope? Sorry, Max.
I think any reasonable person would sort of dismiss these kind of things. But it's interesting that since the Black Lives Matter thing and the death of George Floyd last year, it's been noticeable that the inclusion of black and minority ethnic people within both TV programs and particularly TV adverts here in the UK has been ramped up massively, to the point now where it's difficult to actually find an advert where that features a wholly white family. Where a family is shown, the family almost invariably nowadays is composed of one white parent and one black parent and mixed race children. Or if a family is shown where all the members of the family are of one ethnicity, then that ethnicity is a non-white ethnicity. And this seems to now be a feature where there seems to be a campaign being waged by the media to convince people in Britain that white people are already in the minority. And that seems to be the case. And so it's ironic, really, that in the face of a campaign like that, that we now have, as a result of that campaign, Gary Lineker appearing in an advertisement for Walker's Crisps, where the advert is attacked by the very same people who would be promoting Black Lives Matter, but attacked for the opposite reason, the advert is trying to create an association between BAME people and the eating of chicken with your fingers, basically.
So it should have been all white people in the advert eating chicken flavored crisps. I guess at least it wasn't watermelon flavored crisps or anything like that. But what it does remind me of is that advert that they had last year where they were trying to target black youths and prevent them from stabbing one another. So they had anti-stabbing adverts and they put them on the chicken boxes that came in the fried chicken shops. And that was quite a good idea, really. I mean, you want to target these adverts to the target audience. You don't want rural folks in their fish and chip shops being targeted to stop them stabbing one another. It's a problem within the black community. So they put them on these chicken boxes in the fried chicken shops, and that was attacked and said that was racist because I don't know why. I mean, are you just not allowed to actually target the correct community with your advertising now? I mean, if they're going to advertise fried chicken, it is something that black people like to eat. So, I mean, you would want to target adverts that are concerning fried chicken towards black people. Surely adverts are supposed to be targeted towards the audience that's most likely to actually buy the product. And this is a really concerning thing, I think, about all these adverts that feature black people, because the black community, it probably only makes up 5 or 6% out of the 15% of non-whites that we have in the country, and they're probably one of the lowest earners. They're not really going to be the sort of people that can actually afford to buy a lot of the stuff that's in these adverts. So it makes you think, well, what are these adverts about? And then you realize that it's not about trying to sell you the product. It's about trying to sell you multiculturalism. That's what it's all about. As you pointed out there, Max, it's trying to convince the British people that we're already a minority and that it's quite normal to see mixed black and white families and mixed race children. It's to get us used to this, but it seems to have backfired. It's definitely backfired, I think, if people are complaining about this token white man that's in this advert. It seems to me that more and more people are actually noticing this. And you were telling me that there's an actual company that provides just specifically black and non-white actors to take advantage of this big drive to boost diversity in the adverts. Is that right?
Well, this is according to the article that I read on the Mail Online. They quote there a chap called Robert Wilson, who they claim is the owner of a London-based modelling company or modelling agency called FOMO Modelling. And it says that Robert Wilson, owner of the London-based FOMO Modelling agency, whose roster is mostly non-white talent, told how he was surprised when Walkers approached his company to request black and mixed race people to appear in the advert. And so where the advertising companies have claimed that they're simply trying to reflect diversity, what we actually find is that according to this report, which is, you know, again, according to what Robert Wilson is supposed to have told the Mail Online, that Walkers specifically requested black and mixed race people to appear in the advert. And so that, again, tends to support the argument that we're putting forward, that there is now a trend both within multinational companies and within the advertising agencies to promote basically to flood the advertising that is featured on our televisions with black and minority ethnic actors in order to, as we've already established, try and convince the British public that we're already a minority in our own land. The article continues that Roberts said that we didn't actually know that there was only going to be one obviously white guy. I think it's a matter for them, i.e. Walkers, trying to keep up with the trends, so to speak. So again, if what the Mail has reported is correct, and what this chap says he actually believes, then there is a trend, in inverted commas, which is to fill your adverts with people who are of black and minority ethnic origin.
You imagine if they'd actually asked for a white man specifically. Well, what we want, white people in this advert. They would be accused of breaking the race hate laws, wouldn't they? They'd be accused of breaking the Discrimination Act. But it's perfectly fine for them to request black and minority ethnic actors. It's perfectly fine for them to have advertising companies that only have black and minority ethnic actors on their roster, so that they can hire them out on these diversity hires. It's really like a double standard that we're seeing there. But I do think more and more people are waking up to it. I mean, I know people that aren't nationalists that have pointed this out and said, I really don't understand what's going on. We're being replaced in all the adverts. There's all these black faces in the adverts, and yet I don't see lots of black faces around me. Why is this happening? There are a lot of people that are very, very confused at this, and they don't understand quite what's going on, because, you know, as I say, normally the adverts you think are going to be directed at the audience that is most likely to purchase the product. But that is not the case here, is it?
Now, and a Walker spokesperson is reported in the article as saying, this advert does feature people of different ethnicities, as the casting for all our advertisements reflects the diversity of the nation and our consumers. We are strongly committed to playing our part in pursuing racial and social justice. So part of the advert isn't to actually sell Walker's crisps. Part of the advert is to pursue racial and social justice. So there's an admission there, if this is correct. But also the other thing it states here is that they are trying to reflect the diversity of the nation. Well, as far as the statistics that are available from the National Statistics Office, the Office of National Statistics, proportion of non-whites in this country is only about 15%. It might be a bit more than that now. It might be 16 to 17%, but that would still mean that something like 80 to 85% of the people featured in our adverts ought to be white, and only 17% of the people featured in our adverts should be from an ethnic minority. But they're not doing that. What they're doing is that they're making it the other way around, so that something like 85% of the people that are featured in our adverts are now from the black and ethnic minorities, and only something like 15% of people featured in our adverts are actually white.
I expect they will say what they're doing is they're future-proofing the adverts. That's what they say with the television, because the BBC have got targets of I think 25% black and minority ethnics in everything. And as you point out, we're only 15% of the population, but they say, oh, yes, but it's predicted to increase. So what they're doing is they're future-proofing the adverts for when there's only 15% white people left in the country, I guess, so that when they look at these adverts in 20 years' time, that they won't think that there's anything different there. But it is really shocking what is going on there. And Gary Lineker, I really don't like Gary Lineker. He's also called for more immigrants to come into the country. He's called for more fake asylum seekers to be allowed in. He said at one point he was actually going to have one living in his house. I don't know if that actually happened or not. I should imagine if it did, it was one of his many houses. I don't believe that he only has one house, or that he was sharing it with this immigrant. He's certainly an anti-white person. He's extremely maladapted, and he's turned against his own group, basically.
I believe that Gary Lineker did actually have an immigrant come to live in his house, but it was just for a short period of time. It obviously was just for a temporary visitation rather than it being permanent. And I would have thought that somebody is with as generous as Gary Lineker would like us to believe he is, and with the resources that he's got available, probably could have given this chap housing for a lot longer, and perhaps could have given more people housing for a lot longer than he actually did, if indeed, you know, he is as committed to the causes that he promotes as he claims.
I'm sure that the fake asylum seeker would have been screened as well to make certain that he was highly educated and not the usual type that we see trying to break into the country. Another news story that caught my eye over the weekend was this Shamima Begum, who was appealing against this, against having her citizenship taken away, and she lost the appeal. And a lot of people did think she was going to win the appeal, and she was going to be allowed to come back to Britain, but she wasn't allowed to come back to Britain. And I noticed on Sunday that the headlines were saying that this has only happened because she's brown. And if she was white, they would not have taken her citizenship away. Well, if she was white, she wouldn't have had a dual citizenship with Bangladesh, would she? That's the point. This woman had dual citizenship with Bangladesh. And in actual fact, she renounced her citizenship when she went to go and join the Islamic State. She was a part of the Islamic State of Syria, which means that once the Islamic State fell apart and Bashar al-Assad was able to take over Syria again, it meant that she was a Syrian citizen. If she was stuck there without citizenship, she should have been given Syrian citizenship because she was a part of the Islamic State of Syria. So I've never really understood quite what was going on with this Shamima Begum thing. And I did think that they were going to allow her back in. I'm surprised that they turned down her appeal. But she did have the appeal on legal aid as well. Everybody in Britain actually paid for that. And there was a rumour that she was actually in Britain at the time, because it's not possible to do these appeals and not actually be there in person. So I don't know if she was actually flown back into the country for that. But it is good news that she's going to have to go to Bangladesh, and she's had her citizenship stripped from her. But it should be all of them that went out there fighting for the Islamic State and renounced their British citizenship. They shouldn't be allowed to just be given that back and have access to everything that British people have after basically pledging allegiance to an enemy nation, which is what the Islamic State actually were. Did you notice that at all, Max? You got any thoughts on this Shamima Begum story?
Well, I did see it featured on TV, yes. And it was interesting that the person who was putting over the government's point of view was careful to explain that Shamima Begum's case hasn't actually been rejected once and for all. She just has not been allowed back into the country in order to pursue her claim. But if she is able to pursue her claim from outside of the UK, then they are quite happy to presumably allow the case to be heard. So I think really what they're almost inviting there is for some friendly international philanthropist who believes in multiculturalism and multiracialism to come along and give Shamima Begum a big financial handout so that she can then afford to fight her case from Syria or from some other place that handout of money enables her to go to. So I think this is probably going to be the next step in this story that we're going to see. We'll just have to see how it pans out in the end.
Perhaps George Soros might like to step in there and stir things up. He's a rich philanthropist, isn't he, that likes promoting diversity throughout the world. Well, there was another news story last week which concerns nationalists. There's this group called the Commission for Countering Extremism that was set up by Tony Blair, and what they've basically been doing is they've been trying to find a way to make more nationalist content illegal. And what they're saying is we've got laws which cover incitement to terrorism, and we've got laws that cover incitement to violence and incitement to hatred on the grounds of protected characteristics. And what they're saying is there's a group that doesn't actually come under those two headings, and they actually used Patriotic Alternative as their case study for this. And what they're actually saying is that there's a group of people that are actually keeping within the law, and we want to still go after them even though they're keeping within the law. So what they've done is they've come up with this new definition which they call hateful extremism. And I do recommend people actually check this out, because we're really being pre-warned here of what the guidelines might change to, and we should try to keep within them so that we don't fall into these legal traps. The Commission's flagship report, Challenging Hateful Extremism, has identified and evidenced a new category of extremist activity described as hateful extremism. And they describe what this activity actually is. They do give it a definition. They say, number one, behaviours which incite and amplify hate or engage in persistent hatred or equivocate about and make the moral case for violence. And obviously, we don't come under that. We don't certainly don't make the moral case for violence. We certainly don't encourage people to hate. I'm often talking about the damage that being a hateful person actually causes to someone. Then they say number two, includes behaviours which draw on hateful, hostile or supremacist beliefs directed at an outgroup who are perceived as a threat to the well-being, survival or success of an in-group. And number three, cause or are likely to cause harm to individuals, communities or wider society. And I don't think we really come under number three. But number two, a lot of nationalists do portray the struggle that we are in as if it being a struggle for survival, and that these ethnic minorities, they are a threat to our well-being or a threat to our survival. And I don't think that is really the case, because the ethnic minorities were actually invited into the country. Our representatives did invite them into the country. We gave them these diversity quotas. We came up with these hate speech laws to prevent us from criticizing them in certain ways. And when you look at it like that, then it's not actually the ethnic minorities that are at fault here. It's white people that are at fault. And I came up with some notes and ways that we can try and avoid falling into this legal trap. And I put, our material should be explicitly directed at our own extended kinship group, and it should not make other groups out to be a threat to our well-being, survival or success. This can be done by portraying our competitors' activities as being necessary for us to improve our own strategies and to improve as individuals and as a group. We require these competitors in order for us to progress as a people. They are not a threat to our survival. Our own people are the threat to our survival. They are the ones who let these other groups in, and they are the only ones who could send them back. They are not a threat to our success either. It is our own people who emancipated these other groups and gave them rights and laws to protect them. This has made life harder for us, but the challenge will sharpen our wits and improve our skill sets as we compete against these other groups who we have given a helping hand to because we are so charitable. So it's all in the way that you actually look at this, and that you look at this struggle. And we do need competitors. We do need challenges there. And we should look at this as the same way that a mountaineer would look at a mountain that hasn't been climbed. And he says, well, that's going to be a big challenge, but I can beat it. And that's what's really going on here. We have taken on this challenge, and we have said, yes, come into our countries. Yes, we'll give you diversity quotas. Yes, we'll give you these hate speech laws. And in effect, that is saying we are prepared to tie one hand behind our backs, and we are prepared to put a blindfold on, and we can still beat you in this competition. And that's the way that it should be looked at. We've been charitable to these people. We can't blame them for taking us up on our charity. We can't blame them for taking our politicians up on their invitation to come into the country. And we just have to make do with the way that these laws are. And I think if this is framed correctly, as we try to do here at Radio Albion, this is not directed at these other groups in any way. We don't wish to change the behaviour of these other groups in any way. The problem is with white people and how we respond to this. We're not working together as a group. We are working to advance the interests of these other groups, and we need to be working together to advance the interests of our own group. We need to be increasing our positive ethnocentrism, which I pointed out the other week. When we do activities that are positive for our people group and the opposing groups, the competing groups, then react against it, their only reaction against it is to accuse us of hate. And it's obviously not hate, it's love. It's love for our own people. So I think this is a way that we can get around this. I'll just repeat what their description is. It's activities which draw on hateful, hostile or supremacist beliefs that are directed at an out-group who are perceived as a threat to the well-being, survival or success of an in-group. What I'm saying is our material needs to be specifically directed at the in-group, so it's not directed at the out-group, and we should not be portraying the out-group as somehow being a threat to our well-being, our survival or our success, because that is giving them so much power that they don't actually have. We are a threat to our own well-being, survival and success. It's our own people who are not breeding. That's what's causing the problem with survival. With as far as the well-being is concerned, well, our representatives put these laws in place, and we have put in place these diversity quotas. So it's our people that need to be changing. You can't blame these other groups for just doing what is in the best interests of their group. The way I see it is, it's white people that are not acting in the best interests of our white people group. And I think if people make that clear in their propaganda and in their podcasts and in their activities, then we will still get attacked by the journalists. But if there are ever court cases, you can point to this and say, look, we're not hateful, we're not hostile to them, we're not supremacists, we're saying this is a competition. Competition benefits all groups. It will sharpen up their skill sets and it sharpens up our skill set. And the best group wins in this Darwinian competition for group selection. Because that's what it is. Max, have you got any thoughts on this? Have you had a look at this, had a chance to look at this report?
No, I haven't seen the report at all, no. What I would say, though, is that broadly speaking, I agree with what you've just said. One of the things that I've been very careful to do over recent years is always to talk about multiculturalism being the problem and not the ethnic minority groups. Because multiculturalism creates the social dynamics that causes different social groups to compete with each other, and it's the fact that we're not competing, we're not actually recognizing white people, generally speaking, don't recognize other white people as being part of their social group, and what's happened is that over recent decades the cohesion between white people has diminished, and so therefore we're not viewing ourselves as being part of an ethnic group that needs to compete with the other ethnic groups if we are to continue to thrive in the future. And it's the social dynamics of multiculturalism and the concept of multiculturalism that damages us and is the threat to us, not ethnic minorities.
Yeah, we're not hostile towards them in any way. You know, if you're running in a marathon, you're not hostile towards your other competitors. And you want the best competitors. You want people that are going to be, you know, a challenge to defeat in a competition. What would be the point if it was just, you know, it was just an easy win? You know, we're white people and we should be looking at this in the way that white people look at things. And we should be saying, yes, we've been very charitable to these people and they would be foolish not to take us up on our charity. But it doesn't mean that we lose all our confidence. As soon as you start blaming these other groups, it's like saying, well, they're superior to us and we've lost all our confidence and all feel sorry for us because look at how terrible things are for us. Well, no, just let's not look at it that way. Look at it. This is a challenge. And all the while that there are white people that are racially aware, it means that their descendants are going to be racially aware and they're not going to be blended out. And so long as there are white people around, then we haven't lost yet, have we? Because it's all about preserving our people and increasing their prosperity. And increasing white people's prosperity, is that's the positive ethnocentrism side. I was very pleased to see the Yorkshire Patriotic Alternative Group have been out litter picking in a park over the weekend. They picked up, I think, 50 bags worth of litter, and other members, or other people rather, that were in the park joined alongside them. And that's exactly what we want to see. Positive ethnocentrism, so that when that gets picked up by the mainstream media and they say, oh, hateful litter pickers, they just look absolutely ridiculous, and PA look good. It's not about being hostile to these other groups. It's about being loving and charitable to our own. But hopefully people will realize that, and they won't be able to go after us with this hateful extremism, because we're not hateful.
I think it's also about us promoting the awareness that where there is competition between different ethnic groups, that competition should be at a national level. And so the nation state has existed for many thousands of years now, and it's at the level of the nation state that there should be competition between people, and so therefore our model for the structuring of society is different from the model that is being currently promoted by Western governments, which is that competition should be at an inter ethnic level within the same national boundaries, which I think is not helpful from the point of view of maintaining good race relations, and it's not helpful from the point of view of promoting the orderly development of society.
Well, this is the other point as well. Is we're not racist, we're not anti-Semites. We wish to do away with all discrimination, and the only way you can do away with all discrimination is if you have ethnically homogenous societies. How can you have racism directed to anyone if you don't have members of other races living in the same territory? How can you have anti-Semitism if you don't have Semites living within the same territory? And of course, the left's answer to that will be, is, oh yes, but how will you remove these people from among you? That means that they'll be removed against their will. And of course, Patriotic Alternative have a specific platform of voluntary repatriation. And it's that word voluntary that is so important. We will try to get people to voluntarily decide to go and live among their own people. And the best way to do that is to make it clear that there would be no racism then. And you can also offer incentives, and it doesn't mean that these people would lose their rights. They would have the same rights as before. Because another part of this is they say that hateful extremists seek to get rid of democracy and they seek to take away people's rights. We don't seek to take away people's rights. We seek to expand people's rights so that you have a right to live among your own people. We want to reinstate the right to freedom of association, this right that was taken away with the Race Relations Act that we talked about last week, which actually brings me to our Greatest Britain this week, Enoch Powell. Should we get into Greatest Britain's now, Max? Do you want to add anything to what I was saying? Yeah, get into that. Okay.
Let's get into it, yes.
Okay, we'll begin with a summary. We talked about how Powell did not just speak out against immigration in his famous Rivers of Blood speech, but also the Race Relations Act, and how it did away with the centuries-old right to freedom of association. After this speech, he was dropped by the Conservative Party, but remained loyal to them, and failed to form his own party, despite having at least three-quarters of the country supporting him. Immigration was soon to take a back seat, though, as Ted Heath took Britain into the European Economic Community without a mandate, and Powell switched his backing to Labour at the next election in the hopes that they would take us out again. The result this time was a hung parliament, but with Labour winning the most seats. The public knew that it was Powell who had swung the election, and he was finally able to get his revenge on the man who had sold British sovereignty to the EU. And unfortunately, Labour didn't then take us out of the EU. You were saying last week they had a referendum and we lost. Is that correct, Max?
Yes. In 1975, there was the first referendum for membership of the European Economic Community, I think, in those days. And the same Project Fear was entered into by the news media and by large corporations in this country, where they tried to make everybody feel that if we didn't stay within the European economic community, that we would lose millions of jobs, that there would be massive unemployment, that the country would be beggared, etc. And so the result of that campaign was that we stayed in. But you know, I always felt that there were inconsistencies which made the election result absurd, which, you know, one of which was that apparently a majority of people in Northern Ireland voted for us to stay within the European Economic Community, when at that particular point in time the troubles in Northern Ireland were at such a point that I couldn't see how the unionist community would have voted to stay within an international structuring of countries where effectively the unionists and the republicans would be effectively power sharing in the same state. So it was my belief at that point in time that wouldn't have naturally happened, but perhaps I was wrong, because the Northern Ireland agreement that's been signed since then would tend to suggest that there is a majority of people in Northern Ireland who want the troubles to be behind them and are prepared to live within the constraints that are necessary in order to enable the peaceful situation that currently exists in Northern Ireland to persist.
And of course, that's exactly the sticking point that there was with the Brexit referendum, wasn't it? They were arguing about the backstop in Northern Ireland for about 4 years, weren't they? And then finally, it was the EU that actually put the backstop in place, even though it only lasted for 24 hours. Well, in the sudden general election of October 1974, Powell returned to Parliament as the Ulster Unionist MP for South Down, having rejected an offer to stand as candidate for the National Front, formed 7 years earlier and fiercely opposed to non-white immigration. He also repeated his call to vote Labour because of their policy on the EEC. Since 1968, Powell had been an increasingly frequent visitor to Northern Ireland, and in keeping with his general British nationalist viewpoint, he sided strongly with the Ulster Unionists in their desire to remain a constituent part of the United Kingdom. From early 1971, he opposed with increasing vehemence Heath's approach to Northern Ireland, with the greatest breach between them coming over the imposition of direct rule in 1972. He strongly believed that direct rule would only survive if the Unionists strove to integrate completely with the United Kingdom by abandoning devolved rule in Northern Ireland. He refused to join the Orange Order, and was the first Ulster Unionist MP at Westminster never to be a member, and he was an outspoken opponent of the more extremist loyalism espoused by Ian Paisley and his supporters. Now, the troubles in Northern Ireland are not really something I know that much about. I have been impressed with the party that joined up with the Conservatives in the power sharing with the Conservatives, and I forget the name of the lady that leads it, but I was quite actually impressed with them and the way that she spoke out against abortion. And it does seem to me that Northern Ireland is probably the most traditionalist minded out of all the governments that we have in the United Kingdom. And I've seen this Ian Paisley's son. I think he's pretty good as well. I think he's a reverend. And this Orange Order as well. I don't know much about them. I think they supported Cromwell. Maybe I'm wrong in that. Max, what do you know about Northern Ireland and this situation back in the 70s?
Well, the situation back in the 70s was that there was a sharp division between the two communities, that the Ulster Unionists obviously wanted Northern Ireland to remain part of the United Kingdom, and the Republican parties, which consisted of Sinn Féin and the Democratic Unionist Party, there was another more moderate party, I can't remember the name of them off the top of my head, who were representing the Republicans, and they wanted effectively a United Ireland, But there was a lot of violence, and this is why I, at the time, I felt that it was unlikely that the majority of people in Northern Ireland would have voted for a for the UK to remain part of the European Economic Community, and for the south of Ireland, for ERA to be part of the European Economic Community as well, because it effectively then meant that Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland were effectively in the same nation state. Now, as we can see, that the resistance to Britain being totally absorbed into a new nation state in Europe has prevented that outcome. But at the time, it was a very real threat. And during our period within the European Union, there were a number of efforts that were made in order to break the United Kingdom up into small pieces that would then individually be so small that they couldn't survive as a nation state on their own. And so there was the encouragement of Scottish nationalism, the encouragement of Welsh nationalism, and also the encouragement of regionalism in the UK, with the hope that with the hope that England would break up into the nine constituent parts that the nine regions that the European Union had marked out for us, as I say, none of those ninths of England could have existed as a separate nation state in its own right, realistically. So that it was just a period of very heightened tension, a period of violence where there were frequent riots and where there were frequent murders of people on either side. I think that the eventual Good Friday Agreement that was agreed was very much a fudge of the entire issue, where effectively the British government's finally admitted that they didn't have the stomach for the fight, and that they were therefore going to accommodate the wishes of the IRA, and where I think intense pressure was probably put on the loyalist paramilitaries to accept the agreement as well, which they appear to have reluctantly done. There was a process during which there was a distinguished chap from Canada who came over to Britain to oversee the destruction of the weapons that the paramilitary groups had. How thoroughly that was done, I don't know, but I suspect that the paramilitaries on both sides have still got caches of arms, and that this is one of the reasons why the government reacted so strongly to the European Union recently wishing to establish a hard border from the point of view of the import and export of COVID-19 vaccines, because it would, by establishing that hard border, that would have been a breach of the Good Friday Agreement and could then theoretically have set the different paramilitary groups at each other's throats again.
They've changed the name as well. I mean, back then it was Ulster, wasn't it? And you don't really hear of Ulster now. They talk about Northern Ireland, and this was the Ulster Unionists. And I'm guessing that the Ulster Unionists became the Democratic Unionist Party, which is actually headed by Arlene Foster. That's the name of the lady I couldn't remember before. Well, in the aftermath of the Birmingham pub bombings by the Provisional Irish Republican Army on the 21st of November 1974... the government passed the Prevention of Terrorism Act. During its second reading, Powell warned of passing legislation in haste and under the immediate pressure of indignation on matters which touch the fundamental liberties of the subject. For both haste and anger are ill counsellors, especially when one is legislating for the rights of the subject. I'm really pleased to see that he was speaking up about that. I mean, who would have thought back then that that would have ended up needing to be used against Islamic terrorists, and that they would have gone after nationalist groups with this legislation, ending up with today with 13 and 14-year-old children being charged under it. Powell said terrorism was a form of warfare that could not be prevented by laws and punishments, but only by the aggressor's certainty that the war was impossible to win. In his later career as an Ulster Unionist MP, he continued to criticise the United States and claimed that the Americans were trying to persuade the British to surrender Northern Ireland into an all-Irish state because the condition for Irish membership of NATO, Powell claimed, was Northern Ireland. The Americans wanted to close the yawning gap in NATO defence that was from the southern Irish coast to northern Spain. He had a copy of a State Department policy statement from the 15th of August 1950, in which the American government said that the agitation caused by partition in Ireland lessens the usefulness of Ireland in international organisations and complicates strategic planning for Europe. It is desirable, the document continued, that Ireland should be integrated into the defence planning of the North Atlantic area, for its strategic position and present lack of defensive capacity are matters of significance. Now, I find this interesting because I always thought that American support for Southern Ireland was because they romanticised their Irish heritage. But according to this, there was actually a strategic basis for this, that they wanted to make better use of Ireland in NATO. Were you aware of that before, Max?
No, I'd say that's news to me, to be quite honest. I think that the there was quite obviously during that period touting for votes by American politicians of Irish extraction, and that touting for votes was in the form of them making promises to the Republican political parties, both in Ireland and also in Southern Ireland and Northern Ireland, and so you know, and we now have the situation where we have Biden talking about what apparently, according to news reports, not being sympathetic to Britain because of his Irish ancestry and the fact that he continues to hold a grievance against England or the United Kingdom as a result of that. And so I think that it's the romantic or overly romanticized Irish connection that was the issue and not NATO strategies. I can't see that Ireland plays much of a part. It's not a frontline state as far as NATO is concerned. You know, it's not got a border with the it didn't have a border with what was the Soviet Union in those days. It didn't have a border with the communist pact countries that composed Eastern Europe at the time. So therefore, what more could the island of Ireland do than provide NATO bases for shipping and things of that sort, for aircraft to land en route from the United States to Britain, or from Britain en route to other Western European countries. There was no further development that could have been entered into that would have made Ireland more significant as a result of Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland being united.
It's interesting that he's really sort of throwing himself into being part of the Ulster Unionists. I mean, he was originally from, I think he was in Birmingham, wasn't he, and Sheffield, and now he's there in Northern Ireland. And Northern Ireland does seem to be the most patriotic part of the country, I would suggest. It's the only part of the country that really has those marching bands still, although they do pledge support for Cromwell. And obviously, I am against Cromwell and what he did in Ireland. I see him pretty much as being one of the first Bolsheviks with his revolution that he had there, the Puritan Revolution. But they are very patriotic in Northern Ireland.
What I would say is that the Unionist community would be patriotic as far as the UK is concerned. I think as far as the Republican communities are concerned, their patriotism will extend down towards Southern Ireland. And so, I mean, I can remember visiting Northern Ireland on quite a few occasions. And if you went into the Unionist or the Loyalist areas, then there were certain places where you would find that every alternate curbstone down the street would be painted red, white or blue. And there would be huge murals painted on the sides of buildings, lionizing various members of the Unionist paramilitaries and sort of being used as recruiting posters for the Unionist paramilitaries and declaring that this part of Ireland was forever British. And in the same way, there were places also in Northern Ireland where there was quite obviously a war being fought. I mean, I can remember being driven in a taxi through the through parts of Belfast and along the Falls Road, where during that time, probably every like fourth or fifth building was completely burnt out. And this was because of the ongoing terrorism in order, directed by the Republican terrorists in order to try and drive the UK government, the British as they called us, out of Northern Ireland. And so this was a, so in terms of patriotism, I think the Irish are a very patriotic people. And I think that the Ulster Unionists, their patriotism is towards the UK, whereas the Republicans, it would be towards the United Ireland, united with the South.
That's a really good point to make. You know, it shows the ethnicity there, doesn't it? It's not an ethnic difference between the Northern Irish and the Southern Irish. It's just a religious difference and a patriotic loyalty difference. Well, although he voted with the Conservatives in a vote of confidence that brought the Labour government down on the 28th of March, Powell did not welcome the victory of Margaret Thatcher in the May 1979 election. Grim was Powell's response when asked what he thought of Thatcher's victory, because he believed she would renege, just like Heath did in 1972. I guess that's on the EEC. During the election campaign, Thatcher, when questioned, again repeated her vow that there would be no position for Powell in her cabinet if the Conservatives won the forthcoming general election. In the days after the election, Powell wrote to Callaghan to commiserate on his defeat, paying tribute to his reign and wishing him well. Now, I think this was an important election because the National Front were doing exceptionally well, and I believe that Margaret Thatcher gave the impression that the Conservatives were going to do something about immigration. And that's why people switched their votes from the National Front to the Conservatives. And then when the Conservatives got in, they did nothing about immigration. Exactly the same thing that David Cameron did when he said he was going to get immigration down to the 10,000 a year. And then they changed it to tens of thousands. And then they quietly gave up on that. But this was started at this point, I believe, with Margaret Thatcher. She capitalised on the anti-immigration sentiment in the country, gave the impression that she was going to put a stop to it, and that's why she was voted in. Am I correct in thinking that, Max? Was that this election?
I believe so, yes, from memory. I think that as far as Margaret Thatcher is concerned, she made a very famous speech where she referred to it being quite legitimate for the British people to fear that they were being swamped by immigration. And it was that speech which caused a lot of people who had previously been supporting the National Front to switch over to the Conservatives, only again to be betrayed by Margaret Thatcher. And it's a recurring thing that every Conservative government has pledged to control or reduce immigration. That used to be that they were pledging to reduce immigration. Now they just pledge to control it. They don't say which way they're going to control it, up or down, but they talk about controlling it. And yet every step along the way, the Conservatives have done the complete opposite. They've not controlled immigration, and they have, if anything, increased it massively in recent years, just as the last Labour government did.
And the National Front have never regained the popularity that they actually had before this election as well. I think they stood a candidate in every seat throughout the country. They were absolutely huge at this time. And I can remember Richard Edmonds talking about how they were really sort of stabbed in the back by the Conservatives, because the Conservatives just capitalised on all this support that was there for the National Front and stole that support away from them. And unfortunately, the National Front never regained that support. And also around this time, we started seeing more race riots. After a race riot in Bristol in 1980, Powell asserted that the media were ignoring similar events in South London and in Birmingham, claiming far less than the foreseeable new Commonwealth and Pakistan ethnic proportion would be sufficient to constitute a dominant political force in the United Kingdom, able to extract from a government and the main party's terms calculated to render its influence still more impregnable. Far less than this proportion would provide the bases and citadels for urban terrorism, which would in turn reinforce the overt political leverage of simple numbers. He attacked the false nostrums and promises of those who apparently monopolise the channels of communication. Who then is likely to listen, let alone to respond, to the proof that nothing short of major movements of population can shift the lines along which we are being carried towards disaster? So there's 3 points there that he's bringing up. He's saying the actual numbers of the newcomers are now sufficient for them to become a dominant political force. And of course, that's what we've seen throughout the country, particularly in London with Sadiq Khan, who is now the incompetent acting mayor of London. He's only there because of the numbers of non-whites there. Another point here, he talks about bases and citadels for urban terrorism. We have 1,000 stabbings a week now in Britain, I noticed the other day. That's not 1,000 people killed, but 1,000 knife crimes every week, 50,000 knife crimes in a year. We do actually have Islamic terrorism. We've had bombs go off. So we do now have bases and citadels being used for urban terrorism. And the third point, he's talking about the people that monopolize the channels of communication, the false nostrums and promises of those who apparently monopolize the channels of communication. So we've got the fake news media there that are covering up for all of this. And the main point he's bringing up is that the media are ignoring these race riots. They're not just happening in Bristol. They've been happening in South London. They've been happening in Birmingham. And the mass media is covering it up and pretending that it isn't happening. And there were quite a lot of these race riots that went on in the 80s, I think. You must remember some of these going on, Max.
Yeah, there were race riots that were going on. I think that one of the things looking back is that the process of multiculturalizing Britain has been far more insidious than perhaps the violent, that we have had the odd pieces of Islamic terrorism that have occurred, but the by and large, what's happened is that the very fact that successive governments have continually promised to reduce then control immigration, the fact that the British people have been confronted with race relations legislation which is aimed at curtailing freedom of speech and from criminalizing people based upon their views and based upon their views, i.e. views that are opposed to immigration, and the fact that the amount of force used in this respect has been kind of overwhelming has tended to mean that firstly the immigrant populations haven't felt the need to be as violent as I think Enoch Powell thought that they might turn out to be, and basically because everything's going their way anyway, from the point of view of the way in which our society is developing, and from the point of view of the British people themselves, our people have to some extent been wrong-footed and left despondent and forlorn, really, by the fact that so many governments now in succession have deserted the interests of the British people. And I think it's come as a shock, a very profound psychological shock to the majority of people of this country, that when they have actually finally come to realise that the established political parties actually don't care a fig about them, that the established political parties are prepared to lie and lie and lie and cheat in order to stay in power and in order to stop the British people from being able to act in our own ethnic interests.
Yeah, you seem to be talking there about them having enough numbers to take over violently. And of course, they didn't need to do that. Tony Blair created the position of Lord Mayor of these multicultural cities that became majority non-whites. So they were just able to vote in non-white leaders. And I'm just wondering, it was this Bristol race riot that took place in the 80s, is that the one when PC Keith Blakelock was beheaded? There was a white police officer that was actually beheaded at one of these race riots. So you would have thought that they would have brought in laws to prevent the race riots, not brought in laws to prevent people from talking about it. Do you remember this incident with PC Keith Blakelock?
It was an estate in London. I think it was one of the kind of southern parts of London. I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head. PC Blakelock, though, and something farm it was, the name of the estate.
Croydon?
I don't think it was Croydon, but there was an estate which had farm in the title. I can't remember off the top of my head exactly what the name of the place was, but yes, there was a riot there in London, and as Enoch Powell said, the riots in London weren't being properly reported, but PC Blakelock was in pursuit of people who were seen to have been throwing petrol bombs, and he became separated from the rest of the group of police that he was with, and was surrounded by a group, a rioting immigrant group, who then stabbed him many times and cut his head off, and that caused a tremendous shock. But again, you see, the media in this country then went into overdrive in playing down, sort of initially acknowledging the shock, but then playing down the implications of that particular thing. And the chap who was initially convicted of being the main malfeasant, who was accused of actually sort of killing PC Blakelock, he eventually, I believe, was released from prison some sort of 20 or so years later, perhaps 30 years later, on the basis that it was the evidence was unsound, and so PC Blakelock's murder has gone unpunished, and he's not been given the justice that he deserves.
Yeah, and I've only heard this mentioned in nationalist publications about this PC Keith Blakelock, but at the moment BBC Radio 4 are doing a series on fascism in Britain, and of course they're talking about the Battle of Lewisham and the left and the big attack that went on there, and the attack on Oswald Mosley's fascists. And we don't hear anything about the long list of race riots that actually took place, and crimes like a police officer being beheaded. You would think that the first time somebody was beheaded in Britain was drummer Lee Rigby, but no, it wasn't. It was a white police officer by these immigrants in London in the early 80s, and these race riots were a regular occurrence back then. And
it was Broadwater Farm, that was the name of the estate where PC Blakelock was killed. And you're quite right, you know, the members of the public today might be forgiven for thinking that the murder of Lee Rigby was the first time anybody in this country had their head chopped off in the streets in sort of inter-ethnic violence, but that's not the case. That PC Blakelock was beheaded in the same way all those years ago, and just as though with PC Blakelock, the Lee Rigby murder has it's not gone unavenged, in the sense that the two people responsible have been sent to prison, but the two people responsible continue to campaign for their release. And I can imagine that in perhaps another 10 or 15 years, that the case will be reviewed, and that because people are so much older and their memories would have dimmed, etc., that the people that killed Lee Rigby may well be released from prison on the basis that the evidence against them is unsound for some technical reason, and that Lee Rigby will also go unavenged.
I think one of the killers of Lee Rigby, he spoke at a Unite Against Fascism rally. We don't see the UAF being banned or Hope Not Hate because of that. Well, I guess we should leave that there, Max, and we'll get into the campaign against nuclear disarmament next week, because he was also a supporter of nuclear disarmament. Unless you've got anything else you want to add today to finish off with?
No, I think I'm happy with where we've reached, and look forward to next week.
Okay, thank you very much for coming on.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.